Welcome back to the Brexit Brits Abroad podcast. I'm Dr. Michaela Benson, a reader in sociology at Goldsmiths, University of London, and the research lead for a UK and a Changing Europe funded project that's all about what Brexit means for British citizens living in the EU27. What I want to do today is to bring you some key takeaway messages from the project. We've been working with British citizens living in the EU27 now for 2 whole years, and I don't think at the outset of the project we had any sense of how complex and twisting the route to today would have been. And I say today as though something happened. Well, of course, we're still in the middle of a Tory leadership campaign. It's not clear at all how the withdrawal agreement that's been agreed between British government and the EU, whether that will ever make its way into UK Parliament and get approved by UK Parliament. So there remains a considerable amount of uncertainty about what Brexit means for British citizens living in the EU27, precisely because of what's happening in British politics at this point in time. What I really want to do today, though, is draw attention to some of those kind of the social consequences behind those political transformations or that political impasse that we seem to be in at this point in time. This is something that stuck with us all the way through the project. From those early days where Karen and I first returned to France and Spain to talk with those British citizens that had taken part in our previous research about their thoughts and feelings about Brexit, we were really starting to register kind of uncertainties, anxieties about what the future would hold for them and their lives, and importantly, the terms on which they'd be able to live their lives. And throughout the project, as we set up the Citizens Panel, as we started to talk to British citizens all across Europe, this has been a pervasive theme. Obviously, alongside that, there's been lots of debate among those British populations. There's been lots of experience, lots of decision making, and the development of different tactics to somehow gain control over their futures and their lives. And with it, we've started to see the very uneven outcomes of Brexit. Quite simply, there's a question to my mind about who can secure their futures in this time of prolonged uncertainty. And that's a question that's accompanied by all sorts of considerations over the financial costs of securing your future, what's opened up and what's shut down by particular forms of action, who has the cultural capital, so who has the levels of education, knowledge and understanding required to navigate this rather unusual and unprecedented moment. Where's the sociology then within all of this? It's one thing to say that there are uneven outcomes. It's another thing to dissect how those uneven outcomes are produced. And I think this is where we move from the data that we've collected through foregrounding and listening to British citizens who live across Europe in a range of different circumstances, in a range of different countries, that we can start to draw out some of the situational and contextual dimensions of what Brexit means for individuals and what this can help us to understand more generally. Just a little recap. The last 2 years have seen us doing an extensive number of interviews with British citizens in France, Spain and Ireland. We've also been engaged through the Citizens Panel with British citizens living across Europe who've been feeding into us via email, via interviews over the internet, through surveys and polls, and collating this body of materials means that we have a wide understanding, a broad understanding of how people reacted not only to the outcome of the referendum, but the impacts that Brexit, those changes to the political and social and legal landscapes within which they live, are experienced within the context of their lives. Simply, we've explored with them how their lives have been shaped by Brexit, their reflections on their sense of identity and belonging, notably as British and European, the dilemmas that they've faced as they think about their futures and what they'd like to do, the practice, actions and behaviours they've undertaken to secure their futures, and their various encounters with bureaucratic and administrative structures in their place of residence. This has produced the largest longitudinal data set concerned with British citizens who live abroad, and it's uniquely captured how they negotiate the protracted uncertainty about what Brexit will mean for them and the terms on which they live their lives. It's drawn out a range of issues, including questions about how and where to settle, access to health and social care, voting rights, and a range of other things around continued freedom of movement, the ability to study across borders among them. And above all, we've heard how disturbing and unsettling the Brexit negotiations have been for them, and especially for those who are more vulnerable within that population. I just want to draw attention to some of the tactics that these Britons have used an attempt to secure their futures. And I say in an attempt because of the full knowledge that we don't really know exactly what Brexit will mean at this point in time because of the uncertainty around what Britain will do in respect to the withdrawal agreement. Among the tactics that people have used for those who can afford it, as I mentioned before, are those who have been in a position to apply for dual nationality. And that's in a position from the point of view of having the terms of residence that are required in order to do this, but also from the point of view of what different member states permit in respect to dual nationality. Others have sought out ways of formalising their residence, so becoming lawfully resident as EU citizens by applying for residence permits or for permanent residence. There are a small number of people who have repatriated, sometimes not exclusively because of Brexit, but for other reasons, like they might have thought to themselves that they would return to the UK at some stage anyway, and now seems as good a time as any. Or in some cases, people are moving on, thinking about where they want to be in the future, bringing that forward to now. Other people we've seen formalising their residence in a place, whereas they might have been part-time, moving between places. So Brexit is changing people's actions. And there are other ways of formalising a relationship to this country within which they live that perhaps we might overlook from time to time, but people who are formalising those personal relationships, often long-standing ones, for example, through marriage or civil partnerships, all of these are routes that people are taking to try in some way to take control of their futures in a situation where their futures have been made uncertain, their future rights and entitlements remain unclear. And these sets of preemptive actions, as I already indicated, they seem quite straightforward on the face of things, but we do have to ask that question of who can afford to take them, as it's clear that these tactics are not available to everyone. And although these seem like a set of practical steps, we also have to recognise that existing alongside these are a set of emotional readjustments that people are making on a daily basis in order to bring some coherence and continuity to their lives. Now, in terms of understanding what Brexit means for people, and in terms of explaining the uneven outcomes of Brexit, it's important that we think about the factors that support people's lives. that contextualise the decisions that they're taking at this point in time. And there's a variety of factors that we might consider while doing this. The first of these is the conditions and terms under which they are or were living and working. And these vary. I'll explain in a little more detail in a minute. We might also want to consider the question of where people live and how residence and migration are administered and governed in those locations. So what are the structures and legislations that support both residence and migration? We might also want to consider their position in local and transnational social networks. So their relationships with friends and family, both in the places that they live, but also in other parts of the world, and notably their relationships back in Britain. In any understanding, in any sociological understanding, we also need to ask questions about how people are socially positioned. And this is a term that signals something of how people are located because of perhaps their class background, their gender, their ethnicity, their sexuality, their able-bodiedness or not, their disabilities. And I think these are really important factors to take into account when we're thinking about people's ability to navigate particular structures, when we're thinking about the uneven impacts of particular legal forms, for example. And finally, a factor that's really important to take into account is embodied factors. So what kind of state of physical and mental health are people in? And how does this predispose them in relation to navigating this changing political landscape? To start then, the living and working conditions. What can we say about this? At present, the negotiations have focused exclusively on the rights and entitlements permitted by freedom of movement. In legal terms, it's important to remember that this is a mobility regime supporting the settlement of workers, retirees, and students. According to the withdrawal agreement, it is in meeting the terms of this directive that British citizens already resident in the EU27 will be permitted to stay put. Thinking more closely with the legal frameworks, and in particular the right to residence, which rests on a dual principle that people should have comprehensive health insurance and not place an undue burden on the state, highlights some of the exclusions at play within existing freedom of movement legislation. Simply, driven by the needs of an integrated European labour market, the ideal European citizen exercising their rights was a worker. The directives established to permit them relatively easy access to settlement in another member state. Under the mantle of freedom of movement, British citizens have migrated and set up home across the EU. However, it's also clear that among their number are those who are now not lawfully resident by the terms of the directive. Our research has brought this to light in unprecedented ways, as the various terms on which British citizens are living and working in the EU27 are made visible through Brexit. This includes, for example, the young and unemployed, particularly in countries where youth unemployment is relatively common, those who live with the support of benefits, and those on limited incomes. The extent of this population who are not lawfully resident is unknown. However, our research reveals that the scrutiny brought about by Brexit on the legal status of British citizens is likely to bring to light an increasing number of cases. From a sociological perspective, looking at who freedom of movement directives in principle and practice, and latterly citizens' rights negotiations exclude, permits insights into who and what is valued within these legal frameworks. Very briefly, exercising treaty rights as EU citizens privileges those who are working or can make a sustained and demonstrable economic contribution in the places they live. And it's these privileges that will likely translate into the ability to secure their futures post-Brexit. However, it's important to question who is excluded from these models. Who doesn't fit that good intra-EU migrant model that underpins assumptions about who is lawfully resident? And this will give us some signals as to who is likely to fall between the gaps with Brexit. Now, I mentioned previously that there is a question about how the outcome of Brexit is experienced within the context of where people live. And I just want to draw this out in a little more detail. At the moment, the current advice to British citizens living across the EU27 is to make sure they're lawfully resident as EU citizens and to document this officially. Our conversations with these Britons offer local and national distinctions in how this is administered, including difficulties faced in attaining this status in some cases. What this has revealed are the challenges of administering need and demand, confusion over how to attain this status and what evidence is required to do so, as well as problems with collating the evidence required in support of applications. So what we've done here is tried to balance the concerns and the difficulties faced by those who are tasked with administering this, as well as to draw out some of the challenges that British citizens living in the EU27 are documenting that they're facing. What becomes clear is that these challenges, both in administering and in taking up, are unevenly experienced across the 27 countries and depend on the extent of existing structures for registering or declaring residence. We've also, through the project, been able to capture the difference between law in principle and in interpretation. For example, in France, where there's been no registration system for non-French EU citizens, and where the majority of British citizens had never applied for residence permits or were discouraged from doing so, state officers have clearly struggled to process the volume of applications and have also provided conflicting advice to British citizens about their future rights. This has undoubtedly added to the high levels of confusion and uncertainty. Further, it highlights how state intermediaries play a critical role in the experience of British citizens living in the EU27 at this point in time. But it would be remiss of us to talk about how people have responded and reacted to Brexit without considering the significant social dimensions to this. In other words, in talking to the British citizens that we've been working with, we find out a lot about their relationships to family and to the different communities and the places that they live, as well as back in the UK. A highlight, I think, of the research that I'd like to draw out is how prominently dual national families feature in the research, positioning themselves as the epitome of European integration. For them, Brexit raises profound questions of identity and belonging. But there are also questions of transnational families and providing care across borders that Brexit has called into question, as people find themselves asking whether they will be able to continue providing this care across borders and on what terms. And what about the future as these caring needs increase? But we also want to stress here that local networks developed through work, through study at the school gates, or through common interests and language, are a valuable part of many people's lives. They shape their sense of belonging to the place they live and feature in considerations about where they might like to live in the future. These networks might also be instrumental in communicating knowledge valuable in navigating Brexit. We've seen Brexit bring about new community formations, civil society organisations drawn together around the rights of British citizens living in the EU27. The extent of this mobilisation is unprecedented and reflects heightened political awareness among such British citizens and concerns over the transformation of their rights, but also their identity, notably as British and European. This is at times matched with new community formations in local areas that provide face-to-face support and knowledge sharing. And these local networks, these transnational relationships with friends and family back in the UK, support networks that are building up are all part of the landscape within which people are trying to make sense of Brexit. Of course, that doesn't mean that everybody is caught up in these networks, that everybody has access to the level of support that's supplied by some of the civil society organisations. And it's remained important to us to think about who doesn't have access to or chooses not to access these community groups. Where do they get information from about their futures, their rights and entitlements? Who are they turning to? Now, I want to return to that point about social position. I've mentioned repeatedly that Brexit has and will continue to have uneven impacts within this population of British citizens. There are several dimensions to this that reveal who is valued within legal framings of free movement and citizens' rights. Focusing on social position reveals how this population is variously stratified and with what consequences for their rights and entitlements, their experiences of life in the EU27. Now, one starting point into this is to ask who had the privilege of not being questioned for the right to move and reside within the EU27. This might also be understood to bring this conversation into the same frame as broader questions of changes to bordering practices across Europe. Who gets stopped at the borders and who can take for granted our rights? And this is where the research that we conducted with British people of colour living in the EU27 has been significant. While on paper these citizens, just as any other Britons, have the right to freedom of movement, before and after the EU referendum, they have been faced with regular questions about their citizenship and their origins and their right to cross borders. This signals how racialised assumptions are about who is British and who is European. Very simply, white bodies are presumed to be the norm and all others are subjected to greater scrutiny. And we see this in their reports of everyday racism, but also in the institutional and structural racism in Europe and its institutions that they draw attention to. But there are other exclusions to the contemporary model of European citizenship that are also made visible through Brexit. The assumption that a European citizen will be able-bodied, financially independent, in good health, mentally and physically, highlight an idea of the citizen as contributing to rather than taking from the state, which similarly permeate public and political understandings of the good migrant. This excludes the most vulnerable within the population, those ill-equipped to deal with the emotional and practical registers of Brexit, among them children and the elderly, the disabled, those out of work, and those with complex health and social care needs. Perhaps unsurprisingly, those already vulnerable are made more vulnerable through Brexit. Their vulnerability does not position them well to secure their futures. What is clear is that the tactics some people have been able to access in order to partially secure their futures are out of reach for others. The more privileged within this population are able to deploy such tactics because they have the knowledge and understanding of the routes available to them through their social networks and their own investigations, and the confidence to navigate these. They also have the financial wherewithal to pay fees for documentation and forms of status. They've been able to support themselves without relying on the state, and in the case of those moving back to the UK, it is those who have kept properties there who were the first to return. Crudely, those from the middle classes are more likely to find ways to secure their futures. This is clearly more challenging for those who do not have the same resources to draw on, those from lower class positions, including their positions in the labour market, young people struggling to find work, women who are widowed, separated and divorced from partners who'd previously supported them, the disabled, the chronically and terminally ill, those receiving social care. Simply, those already vulnerable through ill health, low income, disability and personal circumstances find these routes to secure their futures out of reach. This is some of the thinking that has framed my interpretations of the disproportionate impacts of Brexit. And it's important as we move on, as we look beyond Britain's withdrawal from the EU, that paying attention to those who fall between the gaps to the variety of outcomes becomes more significant. But it does, as I hope I've highlighted, raise broader questions about who can move, who can settle, and how these disproportionate impacts of Brexit are tied up with, as I hope I've demonstrated, the broader exclusions that are written into existing legal frameworks, that are written into assumptions about who can move, who can settle, that are written into how we understand who is a citizen. Thank you very much, and I will be back again soon with another episode. You've been listening to the Brexit Brits Abroad podcast, hosted by me, Dr. Michaela Benson, and produced by Emma Halton at Art of Podcast. The series is part of a UK in a Changing Europe funded research project, Brexit Brits Abroad, that's all about what Brexit means for UK citizens living in the EU27. We're really keen to hear from you about the issues and concerns we address in the programme, so please do get in touch with any thoughts, queries and questions. You can find our contact details on our webpage, Brexit Brits Abroad, or get in touch via social media. We're on Twitter at BrexpatsEU, and we have a Facebook page, Brexit Brits Abroad. Finally, in case you're not already subscribed to the podcast, you can do so on both iTunes and Google Podcasts. Thank you for listening, and I'll be back in a couple of weeks with the next episode.